On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we have a special roundtable discussion with the staff of the Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies about current regulatory issues, activities, and observations, including discussions about education programs, life safety issues, challenges for owners new to the ASC world, and benefits of computerizing credentialing and employee files. We also follow up on our discussion of the March 2019 MedPAC report, talk about the new 888C Advanced Orthopedic Certification, and update you on upcoming activities in the ASC world.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a biweekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys. Welcome to episode 51 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for Monday, April 15th, 2019. We're recording from our studio in Rochester, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey. John is one of the leading experts on all aspects of the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and he's the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including the Survey Guide for ASCs and the recently released Finance and Accounting for ASCs. John also speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics, and he is the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. So we're recording this episode on Sunday, April 14th, and it will be available April 15th.
But both are very special days.
I know. So we've done our taxes. April 15th is tax day, but am I missing something today?
It's the Game of Thrones.
Oh, well, I know about that. We've been looking forward to that for.
And it is 8:42.
We've been cramming.
It's 8:42 p.m. as we're recording this, so we have 18 minutes to record this segment.
So if we're talking really fast.
So we have a special episode today. We brought the staff of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies together, or at least those that are in town, for a roundtable discussion of things going on in the regulatory landscape. So I thought it would be a lot of fun to have them all together. I believe it's quite a long section, so we'll try to make this part brief. But first, let's talk about some of the news in the industry.
We talked about in our last episode the 2019 MedPAC. Just thought we'd go a little farther into that. So first question, what is MedPAC? The Medicare Payment Advisory Commission is an independent U.S. federal body headquartered in Washington, D.C. MedPAC was established by the Balanced Budget Act of 1997. The commission's 17 members bring a diverse expertise in the financing and the delivery of healthcare services.
So the MedPAC report, as we mentioned during the last episode, had two major conclusions. Number one, that Congress should eliminate the calendar year 2020 update to the Medicare conversion factor for ambulatory surgical centers, which in English means no, they're recommending that there be no increase in the reimbursement rate for ambulatory surgery centers in 2020. And I mean, first of all, CMS has pretty much ignored their advice for quite a number of years. So fortunately, this is no different, I would suspect. And then the second conclusion was the secretary should require ambulatory surgical centers to report cost data, which they have been recommending again for quite a number of years. So let me talk a little bit about the cost reporting section. The commission recommended that CMS collect cost data from ASCs to identify a price index that would be an appropriate proxy for ASC costs. So what they're doing is they're recognizing that what we're using right now, which is the consumer price index, is not a great proxy. And they're suggesting that we really should be using something based upon ASC cost data. However, as we all know, the ASC industry has opposed the collection of cost data for this purpose, and CMS does not yet collect this data. In 2018, CMS requested comments on whether the secretary should collect cost of data from ASCs for use in determining the payment rates. Representatives of individual ASCs provided comments that generally opposed the policy that would require ASCs to submit formal cost reports, but were willing to complete surveys on the condition that they would not be administratively burdensome. The commission, however, continued to assert that all other institutional providers submit at least an abbreviated version of a cost report to CMS, including smaller entities like hospices and home health agencies. Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked about this in the past on the podcast, and we've said that we are very much against this cost data. It is extremely burdensome, mm-hmm. very time-consuming. Yeah. And they cited in their report the example of Pennsylvania, which is kind of interesting. It says, this is what they said. Moreover, the ASCs in Pennsylvania are able to submit revenue and cost data each year to the Pennsylvania Healthcare Cost Containment Council. So it is clear, this is what they said, that submission of cost data is feasible for ASCs. Indeed, submitting revenue and cost data does not appear to be adversely affecting ASCs in Pennsylvania, where 7 more ASCs opened in 2017 than in 2016. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Sue, as you well know, one of the important things that we do with AHS is do cost reports in mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. New York. As a matter of fact, we're the largest provider of cost reporting for ambulatory surgery centers in New York. And I'm not really bragging about that because that is an extremely burdensome mm-hmm. process, takes a yeah. lot of time. And actually, we have to bring on part-time staff in order to do this. And I know that none of our clients are very happy about having to pay the okay. money to do this. The MedPAC seems to have ignored the cost reporting in New York State, which is extremely well known and extremely expensive and burdensome. So that's probably why they didn't mention it. Now, I think one of the reasons for this is that there is no ASC representatives on MedPAC and therefore no input other than the ASC competitors mm-hmm. and those that are not at all involved in the industry. I actually asked. I tried to get on MedPAC myself because I thought I would be a good representative, but mm-hmm. I, of course, was turned down. I mean, I'm not sure that they're really interested in expanding beyond, you know, the hospitals and mm-hmm. Other representatives that probably have more political power than ASCs do. And I think it is very sad that, unfortunately, we're not represented, and yet MedPAC continues to make all of these comments. So, mm-hmm. Other things that came out of the March 2019 MedPAC report is that just some statistics on ASCs. So in 2015, there were 5,216 Medicare certified ASCs. In 2016, it went up to 5,474. And in 2017, it went up to 5,603. So that's about 130 between 2016 and 17. So in 2015, 176 centers opened and 114 closed. In 2016, 159 opened and 90 closed. And in 2017, 189 opened and 60 closed. So the number of closures have continued to decrease since 2015, and the number of openings have also increased. Now, the MedPAC report noted that the majority of Medicare-certified ASCs in 2017 specialized in a single clinical area, with gastroenterology and ophthalmology being the most common, and ASC specialized pain management services are growing as a share of ASCs. Mm-hmm. So in 2017, 61% of ASCs were single specialty and 39% were multi-specialty. And the most common single specialty ASCs were gastroenterology at 21% and ophthalmology just a little bit less than gastroenterology, also at about 21%. The most common multi-specialty ASCs that focused on two specialties in 2017 were specializing in pain management and either neurology or orthopedic services, no big surprise, which represented about 6% of all ASCs. Now, no surprise to us, since quite a number of the centers that we've been opening lately mm-hmm. and certainly been involved in lately have been pain management. Okay. From 2015 to 2017, ASC specializing in pain management services grew most rapidly. Across both single specialty and multi-specialty ASCs in 2017, there were roughly 100 more pain management ASCs than in 2015. So very exciting news for those of us that are involved in pain management.
And AAAHC announced its new Advanced Orthopedic Certification. A new program is available to AAAHC-accredited organizations that perform total joint replacements and or complex spine procedures. And the requirements are, number one, ASCs are in good standing with a AAAHC accreditation when the application for certification is initiated. Two, the specialty service has completed a minimum of 20 procedures for each specialty type, such as total joint replacements and or complex spine procedures, those two, within the 12 months prior to submitting an application for certification. And three, the median number of procedures for each specialty type, total joint replacements and or complex spine procedures, includes inpatient and outpatient, performed by surgeons participating in the specialty services, is at least 50 prior to the date the application for certification is initiated. The median number of at least 50 must be maintained annually as well.
According to HHHC, the goal of the certification program is to provide highly clinical relevant resources that recognize centers of specialty excellence. And they also stated, which I think is very interesting, that they plan to extend the certification program to include more specialties in the future.
And through an on-site survey, HHHC surveyors will assess performance using detailed standards focused on the delivery of orthopedic services. The on-site survey is an educational experience conducted by peer surveyors responsible for reviewing a facility's operation and sharing best practices. Surveyors identify areas in which the facility is effectively demonstrating quality and compliance to HHHC standards and the gaps in performance that may require corrective action. HHHC Advanced Orthopedic Certification Standards include six chapters separated into two areas, leadership effectiveness and care integration. And just a reminder about Medicare quality reporting, it is due on May 15th.
So that's making sure everybody gets, we talked about this in the last episode, so if you don't remember what to do for Medicare quality reporting, you might want to check with episode 50, but the deadline to report on qualitynet.org is May 15th, 2019. And with that, we're going to take a short break and come back and have our AHS roundtable. Okay, and we're back. So, Sue, you and I just finished watching The Game of Thrones since we ran out of time and yes, doing part one. So I can't
and
believe
we're... And I think you were speaking a little fast.
So I didn't want to introduce our AHS roundtable. So what we did on Friday, we got together the whole crowd for one of our regular meetings. Mm-hmm. And we spent about an hour in the afternoon and just got them all around a round table. Well, it wasn't actually kind of an L-shaped table. And just asked them all a bunch of questions about things that are going on in the in their respective areas of expertise. So let's listen to the round table. Okay, this is John Gailey. I'm here with the staff of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. We are at one of our staff meetings in April, and we thought it might be interesting to kind of talk a little bit about all the things that have been going on in the last couple months within our company and some of the issues that we've identified and challenges that we find our clients dealing with right now. So this is kind of a bit of a very informal discussion. So let's start. So one of the things that has been happening is we have a lot of new centers that have started up or are in the process of starting up recently, and all of our staff has been involved in it. Jenna, though, you have really been taking the lead with many of the new centers, both from centers with individuals that have no experience at all, as well as people that have been converting from an office-based surgery center, and some that are surgery centers that have been up and running, but they realize after they've been up and running for a while that they're not, you know, meeting all the requirements at this point, that they need some assistance. Can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you've seen with some of your centers over the last couple months?
I think some of it is, especially coming from an OBS to a surgery center, not realizing that there's a lot more things involved that you have to do. There's different reporting requirements, different aspects of the quality improvement program that you need to have.
Right.
And, you know, just getting everything to that next level, I think a lot of people struggle with.
Yeah, and understanding that the state reporting requirements are often, well, almost always quite different between an office-based setting and the surgery center setting. You know, we work in New York, and actually we found one of our new centers was still reporting to the same agency that they were reporting to as an OBS, and in an ASC environment, they don't have those same reporting requirements. And I think that kind of gets to the issue of making sure that you know your state reporting requirements up front. And if you don't, certainly, you know, check with your state to determine what you can do. Now, Jen, the other thing, especially talking about OBS to ASC, talk a little bit about how much more work
is involved in quality improvement in the ASC setting? What types of things are different between those two settings?
So there's a lot involved with infection control and emergency preparedness that are a lot higher standards for surgery centers versus OBSs. In the surgery centers, you need to have a infection preventionist.
That reports to the governing body. I mean, that's actually a CMS requirement.
And they need to be someone who's qualified to be the infection preventionist. I know we've talked a lot on the podcast about the new CABE credential.
Right.
There's not a requirement yet as to what...
What qualifies for training.
Yeah, but they do need to have some sort of training in infection control. And then surveillance, I think, is a lot more stringent in the...
So why don't we talk about surveillance? Because I know we've talked about it during the podcast, but it really is quite a bit more complex in an ASCA setting. And we know that many of our settings, you know, we do a lot of GI, we do a lot of pain management where, you know, there's little opportunity for infection. You know, unlike an orthopedic place or, you know, OBGYN where you have more, you know, more opportunities. In those types of settings, there's less opportunity. But that doesn't mean that those programs are any less intense.
Yeah, and I mean, you definitely want to be doing your hand hygiene everywhere. We know as an industry, people are not great at hand hygiene.
Right.
So it's always something you want to be monitoring. I like to have all of our centers do sharp safety surveillance. There's a couple good resources out there of, you know, surveillance sheets that you can use. The other one that we always do is your environmental rounds. And then we've been recently trying to get better at doing operating room attire. Because we know everyone is, we have a lot of issues with masks and compliance with like taking off your masks and switching out your masks. And then also, depending on what infection control guidelines you're using, the skull caps versus bouffants, hair coverage in general seems to be a problem. And even in our GI centers, we like to do the surveillance, especially in the scope reprocess in room, not so much for their sterility, but for their own self-protection, because that's another place we see for non-compliance is compliance with wearing PPE in the scope reprocessing room.
I think it's important to note that when you're looking at the regulations, often people look at the CMS regulations and are looking for specific information with regard to infection control. And yet, you're not going to find it there. Like OSHA requirements, for example, tell you about the importance of personal protective equipment. And that's what we'll, you know, you'll usually have to default to when you're looking at what's going on in the sterile environments, as well as ARN and the APIC standards.
And then the other thing that we've been encouraging our centers to do surveillance of is either their scope reprocessing room or their sterile processing room, making sure that the nurse manager or whoever's overseeing that department is familiar with what their techs are doing and are they following the procedures properly. Right. Even just taking the instructions for use and making sure that they're following them is another important way to make sure that everything is running as smoothly as you want it. And then as far as emergency management goes with the new, I guess it's not new anymore, but the CMS regulations that changed in 2017, making sure that you have a hazard vulnerability assessment that's different from the OBS side, and making sure that you have the appropriate emergency preparedness plan to meet CMS standards. It's a lot more intensive than the requirements in an OBS.
To that end, the different types of risk analyses that we have to do on an annual basis are really becoming much more to the forefront. So, Alex, can you talk a little bit about the annual HVAs that we need to do for all of our centers? Every ambulatory surgery center should be doing this.
Yeah, like you were talking about, we have the HVA for disaster preparedness. We have risk assessments now for tuberculosis, which we've had for a while, but that's coming to the forefront again through OSHA. We also have, in terms of life safety, NFPA 99, and you have your operating rooms,
like
the wet versus dry.
Right.
There's so many out there now.
Right. and making sure you keep track of them, that information is reported back to the governing body in some way, either through the Quality Improvement Committee or what other function you might have.
Absolutely. And making sure that what your building is built to is actually what you're using to, you know, go into that, especially with the NFPA 99 risk assessment. And that really feeds into what goes on to each of the branches for your electrical, what is considered to be critical to patient care.
Yeah.
And then which chapters of NFPA actually apply to your center, NFPA 99 actually apply to your center. That all comes off of that NFPA 99 risk assessment.
Let's talk about the HVA for a second, because one of the issues that we've come up, now we're through more than 1 year cycle. And I think sometimes people tend to default back to the most, you know, like their last year's HVA. And yet that's one of those things that's actually most likely going to change every year, not because your risks are going to change, but because during a current year, you might have focused on something, done some training. Everybody is, you know, in 1 year, they might not be ready for it, which means that the risk, the overall risk there is higher than the next year.
Absolutely. There's two very important parts of the risk assessment. One is sort of going to be your constant, which is the risk of the area that your center is in.
Especially the risk of something's going to happen.
Right. So that's like the probability and the outcome that you get. You're rating the severity of the outcome.
Right.
And then the second part is the preparedness. And that's the part that's most likely going to change the most year to year.
Like, for example, one of our centers, they last year did an active shooter drill. Then as a result of their active shooter drill, they put in a panic button. So that automatically show that you're more prepared. Plus, you did training at the same time on what your policy was. So you had training, you had a drill, and then you had a level of mitigation in the panic button.
And you rewrote your policies in order to accommodate all those changes.
Absolutely.
So that year, that dropped down, and then something else obviously moves off.
Mm-hmm. You know? Exactly. Yeah, so that'll... And the sometimes the actual disasters that you're looking for will change year to year.
Right.
Active shooter wasn't always... such a big issue. Now it's come to the forefront of our brains, and that's a big thing that we focus on now.
And you also might have some issues. For example, one of our centers had like 3 power outages last winter, and they might not have marked that as high before, but then you have a winter with 3 power outages, that's definitely going to go up in your likelihood.
Right,
exactly. Things like water loss, people don't think about a lot, but if you live in an area that has water loss frequently, you focusing on it. But the rest of us typically think of that as, oh, that'll never happen. And then if it does, then the next year you're probably going to want to focus on that quite a bit.
Let's talk about internal drills for a second, too, because that's been one of those areas that often people think of, you know, the regular ones, the Lincoln hypothermia and Code Blue. Now, so we've been encouraging people to do some different types of internal drills. You want to talk a little bit about some of the drills we've been doing?
Well, we deal with a lot of smaller centers. And so one of my favorite ones to do, especially with my centers that are only ever going to have one procedure going at a time, and then most likely only one doctor or one surgeon and one anesthesiologist in the building at any one time, I like to do an incapacitated provider drill, because first of all, with one surgeon, one anesthesiologist, you probably have maximum of 3 nurses in the building.
Right.
And what are you going to do if one of those, you know, one of the doctors becomes incapacitated? Who are you going to call on? And how are you going to deal with the situation? Luckily, a lot of our centers that are like that are either small pain centers or GI centers. So it's not as risky of procedures that they're doing that, you know, it'd be difficult to like close up the patient, but it always does bring on a really good conversation, I think.
Right. Especially if when you're running those drills, you really have a good conversation. You walk people through it. You know, we all know drills are things that if done poorly can be quite boring and nobody will give your attention. But I mean, that's one thing Alex and Jenna have been very good about, is making these things, interesting and challenging, and have, you know, you spark good conversations during this. When I do a real drill, or if we do a tabletop drill, actually I gotta admit I like tabletops more, because it gives me more of an opportunity to really have a conversation. Right. And it, you know, instead of people worrying about where they are and what they're doing, here you're sitting down and you're, you know, you can run through a whole bunch of different scenarios.
What if this happens?
And
what
if
a lot of times, sometimes even if we are doing an acted out drill, we'll do a tabletop, but
you sit down afterwards and say, okay, what could we have done?
Or before.
Alex just did in one of my centers an active shooter, And he had a long conversation before.
Right.
This is what I want you to expect. This is what I want you to think about. All sorts of questions came up. Then they did the actual drill. And then all those questions became different questions.
Yeah.
Okay, so then what about this? So really, there's like a table component at both ends.
Sometimes we'll do the drill, and then we'll have a conversation. And they're like, can we do it again?
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
But that's when you know you got them, that they that's were right. engaged in the...
So let's talk about, unfortunately, you know, we have a lot of clients. So during any given year, you know, we're going to have something like a code. You know, we've had a code this year during one of our centers. And we've learned a couple lessons from that. And I think one of the biggest lessons is that we really should be taking these code drills very seriously. It can happen in any place. And, you know, the more prepared we are for it, the better able we are to, you know, deal with that crisis. Jenna, why don't you talk a little bit about what types of things do you think makes for a good code blue drill?
Well, definitely, I think it's good to have a conversation before the drill.
Right.
And it depending on your center and the size, a lot of times the nurses, the thing that they struggle with the most is who does what? How are roles assigned?
Yeah.
So that's a good conversation to have. And
because we know, to that end, we know, especially in the drill, the event that we had this last year, everybody responds. You know, we had multiple doctors in the room at the time. We had multiple anesthesia providers in the room at the time. And, you know, there was one person that was in charge, but there could have been some confusion for people walking in. It's almost like you have to put a hat on top of the person that's in charge, you know, so that everybody knows what's going on.
Jenna, when you do a code drill, do you bring out their policy? Because some of the policies will actually stay. The circulating nurse will do this. You know what I mean? So I know that some of my centers have policies right like that. So do you go over their policy before you even begin?
We normally do. Okay. Yeah. And then especially a couple of my centers that are newer centers, there's been issues with, like, one center, for example, switched from using an AED at their office to using a Zoll or a defibrillator at their
ASC.
At their ASC. And that caused a little bit of confusion because it was a whole new machine that everyone needed to be oriented to. And also the nurses now and the doctors now had to actually be identifying their rhythms,
right.
Which suddenly, even though everyone was ACLS certified, you know, if you don't deal with it often, there is
sometimes
a little
you're
bit
out of practice.
Yeah, yeah, a little out of practice. So
yeah.
You don't want to have a lot of practice.
But it was a great conversation, and we did a new, you know, immediately after that, we were like, okay, let's do an in-service on cardiac rhythms.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing that is great to do when you're doing a code blue drill is opening up the code cart and making sure everyone knows where everything is.
Yeah, and what's available not even in a code cart. Other things that you might potentially need during that thing. Maybe the succinylcholine, for example, you know, is often in the refrigerator, not immediately.
Well, I know when I used to do codes in the hospital, for some reason our code carts never had enough flushes. So after a while, us nurses got really good at, okay, as soon as the code cart, someone runs out and grabs an entire, you know, handful of flushes and puts it on top of the cart. Or maybe they were in there and could never find them. That's also entirely possible in the craziness of a code. But that's like one thing. So it's a good thing for everyone to have time, you know, because a lot of times that code cart is locked up. And so people aren't familiar with it. I mean, hopefully you're not using it often. So so going through drawer by drawer and making sure that everyone knows, you
where
know,
everything is.
Where everything is,
yeah.
I think is a great thing. And then also in the code blue drills, I like to put a lot of steps into my code blue drills, have a really well thought out scenario, include rhythm strips that the doctors have to identify, and then kind of challenge you of, you know, okay, so now the rhythm's this, what are you going to do now? And okay, do they have a pulse?
Right.
Are they breathing on their own?
Speaking of somebody that's had to give those strips to the doctor, I can assure you that they do get some good reaction. But it does get them much more engaged in it, I think. And acting out whatever they needed to do during that drill is a lot easier when they know what they're being confronted with during the actual drill. So we found a couple things that are different that might be good for drone. We talked about an incapacitated provider, but even something as simple as all of a sudden no longer having your EMR system in the middle of an actual case. And that can be quite consternating for people. I mean, if you know your computer system's down, you might decide not to do cases, but what happens if the system goes down in the middle of a case? So having a drill dealing with that, going back to paper,
Well, one of our centers actually had their EMR system go down, and as a result, ended up saying, wow, we should really have a paper backup system. So they did. They created a, you know, a paper medical record to use in that event.
So and we wrote that up as a drill when that happened, too, because of the experience they went through. I guess this is another good point to state something that's kind of obvious, but we need to say it again, is that drills are meant to go wrong. You know, a drill where we say everybody acted appropriately, this goes even for a fire drill, is probably not a good learning experience. We want to push them to the point where things are not going the way that the staff thought they were going to go.
We want to do worst case scenario.
Correct, correct. So what are some of the other types of drills that they might be thinking about internal for internal type disasters?
Well, one item that that comes up all the time, so often that we almost don't even need a drill for it, is HVAC failure.
Yeah.
That's something that a lot of centers, especially the older centers that get stuck with a certain HVAC system, you know, a lot of centers end up dealing with this and have to work on keeping their temperature and humidity.
Right.
The wrong airflow. And the wrong airflow, that's actually even more common, probably.
Right.
Because a lot of the architects and engineers don't necessarily know the specifics of the airflow come from ASHRAE.
Yeah.
So that's a common one. I would even say
power outage.
That one as well. That's very, very common. And one that might be actually kind of interesting to start paying more attention to is hazardous material spill internally. I feel like we've kind of gotten away from that in recent years. That'll kind of help you drill for your SDS sheets.
Right.
And, you know, remember to keep an eye on those. And when you're cleaning up those chemical spills, which is probably mostly in the sterilization area, what do you have to be concerned about?
Right.
And then similar to what you guys were talking about earlier, thinking about the computer system, cyber attack.
Yeah.
I definitely think in the ASC industry, we have a tendency not to pay attention to our IT system or not being big enough to really have a robust IT system.
Right. And we've actually had among our centers 2 cyber attacks in the last 18 months, I believe.
Yep.
Well, one was at our center. One was to the hospital that provided some services to the center, which impacted us because of their the use of them for testing.
Yeah. And as IT people love to remind us, those are the cyber attacks that got through.
Yeah.
You know, we're attacked every day with our emails, all of our systems. So those are definitely something.
Especially as more and more centers move to EMRs.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of touching on education. Let's shift gears a little bit toward education. And Judy D'Ambrosio is our Director of Educational Services. She's charged with developing educational programs for all of our clients, as well as in services when additional education needs to be done. So, well, before we get into the types of training that we do, let's talk about the importance of it. We run into challenges. I think one of the things that we find when we take on a new client is that we're always surprised at how little education they're often doing. Or they feel like, I did the education when I first started and that's all I needed to do.
Yeah, I'm amazed at how often I'll go in and go, well, you know, I did the orientation when I got here, so I should be all set.
Right.
And all of our centers do competencies too. So they figure, okay, I was oriented and I'm competent. And even beyond the idea that it's a triple HC standard, that you have mandatory education, you know, beyond that, things change and life changes and the world around us changes.
And people move into different roles within an organization and, of course, new employees come on board.
So that yearly, either a yearly sit-down or if one of our clients happens to be using an online system, that time is really not wasted. It's really not a waste of time because there are things you forgot from year to year. And there are things that are brand new. Each year, New York State went through a whole lot of changes. This year that I needed to add to our educational programs for New York State. But really, it could be added to every state. Coming to a state near you. I had to add programs for human trafficking, which 20 years ago probably wasn't even a word. And a new...
Sexual harassment.
The sexual harassment and elder child and domestic abuse. And those weren't in our programs before this year. That would be added the year before last.
Right.
And again, I think that was too just a New York State mandate, but it's in all of them now because it's just because it's not mandated doesn't mean you don't need to learn it. You know, so I don't pay a whole lot of attention to, oh, that's a New York State thing. Because if it's worth learning for anybody, it's worth learning for everyone.
Right.
And yeah, people forget. I'm not sure if... And I worked in a hospital. I understand. Oh, it's mandatory. Like, I remember that feeling, and I have to spend the time to do that. But every year I sat and did it, you're reminded of something. You know, you relearn something that you forgot you needed to know.
I was in a center. Actually, yesterday we were doing a mock survey. The day before yesterday, doing a mock survey. And of course, in my inimitable way, I went up to an employee. By the way, she was an employee that had been there for 10 years. And I said, what is race? And first of all, she got like terribly embarrassed. And, you know, because I put her on the spot so quickly. And, you know, she kind of knew, she didn't know the order, but she did know all the things that needed to be done. But, you know, those are another sign that perhaps it might be better to.
And we all know what it stands for. We've always known. But there you are. You're standing there. You're in a group of your friends. And here comes somebody important and you have to know it. Like, and you don't. You know, you just. So, yeah, education is definitely not a waste of time. I do not say that just because I'm like the education girl. So, of course, it's not a waste of time. But sometimes they need to be reminded just how important that time is.
So the wave of the future right now is everybody's going with these online training things.
You can, hate them.
Yeah, you can buy them from ASC Association. They're excellent programs.
They are.
But what's wrong with turning all of your education over to an online program?
The online programs are well done. They're well written, and they're certainly all-encompassing. I'll give them that.
Well, all-encompassing in a general format.
In a general format.
Yeah.
And I'm not selling our services or anybody else's service, for that matter. But much like you and Jenna had just discussed, before you do a drill, you end up with a really interesting conversation. I enjoy doing a full staff, in-person, coming in the morning, bringing donuts kind of mandatory education. It's done once a year. Sometimes those are the only time in a year you see some of the employees at a center because you only deal with a few. So that is good. And it does bring up conversations. And I believe wholeheartedly, I mean, not just because I like to hear the sound of my own voice, you're going to remember a conversation you had with a coworker about this way longer than you're going to remember what I said. So the conversations that come about during an education are priceless.
Right.
And the computer's just not going to talk to you.
Well, a lot of times I think you get into this culture where you go click, 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 and then
false, false, false. You know, you don't even
take the test at the end.
Or even if there's a video, and then you kind of turn it on, you go and do something else, go back and answer the questions. But you know, when you have the in-person training, you can get
And
the binders that we make for the clients that do use this service are lovely, and I think they're great. And we do have clients
afterwards.
But I have clients that say, no, just give me the book and we'll go through it ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. Yeah. But you really miss that aspect that's so valuable.
Right.
Two nurses that have worked together for 20 years are going to have a conversation they remember more. You know, I'm nobody.
Well, and I'm someone who always learns best from stories or from personal experiences. So, and I think, especially when I used to, you know, train new nurses, when you have a reason of, you know, something serious happened and this is why you need to do something a certain way, I think that kind of scares you into thinking like, okay, I need to always make sure that I do it this way because if not, this could happen. You know, giving real life experiences, it just makes it put something in your head, you know, that's going to trigger later on.
Yeah. What I also like about ours, and I'm not trying to sell anything, I'm just the way I look at it. The computer is done, like John had said, although very encompassing, very generalized. So when we come in to do even an in-person or even if they just keep the book kind of education, that's written for your center. Mm-hmm. Those are your policies. Mm-hmm. I'm teaching what you want. It isn't.
And that is required. I mean, we're not just saying that it's a good thing.
It may very well be required, but I'm sure a lot of these online ones cannot possibly know what you sent, you know, unless. And perhaps I shouldn't say that because I'm not actually aware of what...
Well, I think most of these online have the opportunity to modify them for the specific policies of the organization. My question is, how often do they actually do that? How often do they have the time to do that? How often do they actually know how to do it? I think often these services are sold because, oh, here's an easy solution. And you do this and you got this nice little certificate.
And
you're all set. Now you get a surveyor like me coming in, and I'm going to ask a few more questions. Like, tell me how did you show all the fire equipment and where all the extinguishers are in your organization? You showed me annual fire safety, but how does the people here know the various equipment and where it is in this center?
And there's no way an online system is going to teach them that.
Correct.
you know, where ours come with the floor plans, and it's part of the orientation is to walk through the
right.
building and see where those things are.
Same thing with something like risk management. We talk about the general premises in an online system of risk management. What do you do in your center? You got to have some type of an incident reporting system. How do you report? Who do you report to? What forms do you fill out?
And I'm amazed when I do these, you know, and I have a room of 30 people, and some of them have been there since the center opened. And I'll get to the part where I'm doing their policies, and I'll say something, and they're like, really?
Yeah.
You know, and it begins a whole conversation. I didn't know the policy was written that way. Why is the policy written that way? And then you have a nurse manager or somebody from the supervisory committee can say, this is why. You know, and once you understand why you need to do something, it makes you want to do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do find that one-on-one stuff priceless, you know.
Yeah. Judy, while we're talking to you, well, both Judy and Janet, since you've been working in this area quite a bit recently, credentialing and employee files. First of all, one of the things that we've been doing with virtually all of our clients, which I recommend to anybody, I mean, I guess in general we should be noting, we're trying to get away from those old binders. I'm tired of the binders. As a surveyor, I don't particularly want to see them. Myself, you know, I finally, even though I'm old, I've gotten into the computer age. So talk a little bit about what we've been trying to do and how that might help you, our audience, to be better prepared for a survey. You know, what are the advantages? How do you do it, et cetera?
Alex, and it may have been Alex and Jen, so I apologize, has created this unbelievable organizational system for your credentialing files. And although it requires you to scan them and make all of those, you know, those piles of papers electronic, that's a one-time time investment that keeps you really, really organized.
And you know what? Honestly, some of my centers are getting those things from the doctor's offices through email anyways. So it's actually...
So the papers are electronic. They're copying them and opening those little foldy things and putting them in the those books that I hate. And I really believe it. The last two surveys I've been at, that surveyor was so happy to just go into my computer and open random documents to make sure they were there. It was easier. It was faster. It was certainly cleaner. And the thing that Alex and Jenna created just helps you keep on track so well. You know, I really can't compliment them enough.
Well, let's point something out, because the system they developed, anybody here can do. Anybody can do. We're not using an online. We're really just using.
I could have done it.
Well, we're using a folder system on your computer where...
Okay, I could have done that part.
Yeah, so I mean, you're not signing up for one of these online services. And there's a lot of services out there that you can sign up for credentialing purposes. But now you can, as long as it's on a protected drive, you can create a folder structure that looks similar to what your binders would look like.
They look exactly like the binders. Okay. It's just electronic and way easier on the surveyor.
Yeah.
And it's super easy for whoever's monitoring the credentialing files, because we put the expiration dates right in the file name.
Yeah.
So you can really quickly look through and say, oh, I need to get a new one of, you know, a new ACLS that's expired.
I found it invaluable. And you're always going to have the one or two clients that say, you know, that hug those folders and want their paper. And I get it.
Well, you know, we have a couple of clients that were switching over to the computer system. They're so happy they're switching over to the computer system, but they have the old paper and letting go of the paper.
Yeah. Well, I have several that I finally talked into letting me do it electronically, and they still keep those files.
Yeah. And now we got even a worse problem, because now we got a paper file, we got an electronic file. Yes. And so this is both for credentialing and for the employee files. There's really no reason why you can't. By the way, unless your state does require you to have the originals, I don't know of any states that do require you to have that.
None that I've worked with yet, but yeah, it's possible.
Right. So I want to shift a little bit. Joining us he was a summer intern with us, Zachary Kalaritis. Zach joined us full-time in January. Zach, you've been with us for about 4 months now. And you came with, tell us a little bit about your educational background first, and then we'll talk a little about your experiences here.
Yeah, sure. So I was a business management and finance major in college. So coming into this industry, I had very little experience with the ASC industry, or really the medical industry whatsoever.
So, Zach, as you've started, you've been learning an awful lot about quality improvement and risk management. And you know a little bit about ISO 9000.
I do, yep.
So what do you find that's different between ISO 9000 and the type of quality improvement program that we have here?
I would say the type of things we do in this industry, much more focused on QI studies and tracking and trending, which are all very valuable tools. And I would say obtaining all these data and finding out what to do with them can be a very useful tool.
Right. So much of ISO 9000, you're dealing with widgets and things like that.
Yeah.
And testing of the the stuff. But here we're dealing with services, mm-hmm. And I think you probably found that too. And now one of the things that you've been starting into is like working on writing the quality improvement minutes. You know, yep. Helping us with the agendas. We've been introducing it to some of the meetings. So what do you think was the toughest thing for you to pick up on as you came into it? What's the thing that's taking you longest to really get your hands around?
I guess one of the most challenging parts is just determining, because there's so many different things that we track and trend on behalf of our clients, what exactly, what type of data we need to collect from them, and then I guess even what to do with it once we have it.
Yeah. What's the most important, too, probably.
Yeah, yeah. I agree.
Because the interesting thing is, because you're coming in with a background that I think is really helpful from the business part of it and the quality improvement thing, but then yeah. You don't have a clinical background, so
right.
You bring your own strengths and
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Challenges.
But John's done that with all of us. Like each mm-hmm. of us has
one area
different. Yeah.
That we're better at one area where we're really
and luckily,
a lot of areas
as we keep growing and we seem to grow like weeds.
Mm-hmm. Really got a good mix, I think.
We have a good mix and yeah. Like we're all really I don't want to say dependent on each other, but have no trouble going, okay, I don't have a clue. Yeah, like, you know, I'll call it. What am I doing? And that's so helpful. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. As a company gets bigger, that is not the case. You know, there's more of a territorial kind of feeling.
Yeah.
And for some reason, we just don't have that. Mm-hmm. You know, each of us is very secure in what we're good at and very aware of what we're not.
Yeah.
And where to go for that support without, you know, any weird feeling. And that's... Mm-hmm.
That gets to the heart of what we should be talking about with our clients, too, is that often the responsibility for various quality improvement activities falls on one person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it behooves you to try to find other people in your organization that can help you out that might have strengths in those areas or take an interest in that area. I mean, as soon as you identify somebody new in your organization mm-hmm. or somebody that takes an interest
yeah.
in something, you know, really, you know, grab them. Work with them and give them encouragement.
Yeah, because they'll always do better at something that they're really passionate about. And when you identify an area of weakness in your organization, make sure to keep that in your mind as you're hiring other people. Like,
yeah.
You know, that you
and if
fill
you are,
all those spots.
If you are one of those poor, unfortunate souls where the entire responsibility of quality improvement lands on just one person,
yeah.
Just bringing in anybody to have that sounding board, to have a conversation about, you know, I think we should work on this. I think this should be a study. Or I think,
yeah.
You know, having somebody that's just as passionate about it as you are, even if it's only about one part of it.
Yeah, you know, finding people you can delegate part of it to that, oh, you know, she's really passionate about this area or that area and let them help you.
So I did want to talk a little bit about incident reporting, one of those things that we talk about with all of our clients. And Jenna, you and I had a conversation recently with one of our newest clients. It was interesting because the doctor here is clearly, he is detail-oriented. He wanted to make sure that, you know, he told us this is a high-quality operation. I want to make sure that everything we do here is perfect. You know, he never wanted to see an incident report because he always felt that that was a sign of weakness. And so we kind of talked to him about the fact that how did he get to where he was? I mean, clearly he has excellent outcomes. His patients love him. You know, there really are, I mean, they had no, you know, adverse events during that time. And they had very few, you know, issues in even the most common areas. But they weren't perfect, right?
No, and it sounds like they were doing quality improvement every day.
Yeah.
They just weren't documenting it.
And he was
acting it up
quickly.
Yeah.
You know, he'd see, you know, he'd walk down the hallway and see, you know, a dust bunny in the corner and immediately call up the company and say, this can never happen again. You know, that was, I don't know if I call it an incident, but it was certainly something that would normally be written up in an environmental, you know, checklist that would go through quality improvement and then you would show that you made an improvement. He fixed it right away.
Or things that might be fire safety hazards or fall hazards.
Right.
Moving equipment out of the way that could be a fall hazard. Things like that are good to write up, maybe not as an incident, like you said, but in your environmental realm.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are like, oh, no, we're not, you know, I don't have anything documented for environmental rounds. I'm like, every time you walk around the center, you are mm-hmm. doing environmental rounds. I am sure of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Just because we give you a checklist that says, you know, you should do this once a month, it's really something that you're kind of documented for the entire month. And don't be afraid to write things down. As surveyors, we like to see that you have been catching that and you've been fixing it.
Yeah, so even if something, the day that you happen to be doing your actual walk around for fun environmental, if everything looks good, but earlier in the month, you know, you already had replaced some pillows that were ripped or you changed out the light bulbs on the emergency lights, things like that, that's great to write down to show that you are continuously doing your quality improvement.
Right. One of the challenges that we've had is identifying and, well, hiring nurse managers. We have at this point, I think, 4 vacancies. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast a number of times. If you are a nurse manager interested in an interesting career in the city of New York, please give me a call. We might have
not
an opportunity
for you. Not just the city of New York, sometimes Central New York, Western New York.
That's true. We have more openings in New York City right now than elsewhere, but yes, everywhere. You're right, Judy. So let's just talk about the qualities of a good nurse manager and recognizing that not all the time, as a matter of fact, less frequently now, are we able to find somebody with all these qualities. Sometimes we have to, you know, bring somebody in and then train them. Any observations for the team on this? I know all of you kind of have an input on this.
Definitely problem solving is one of the most important skills to have, because especially we've seen the problem a lot from nurses who come from the hospital to an ASC, that from a hospital you're used to having a lot of backup and a lot of people you can go to, you know, if something is not going right. In the ASC, you don't have that.
That's right.
And you kind of need to solve the problem yourself.
Yeah, have the confidence to be able to find the answers on your own, or even being willing to ask questions when we meet with somebody for the first time. If there's somebody that seems really energetic and excited about their opportunity and are asking questions, that's much better than meet with somebody who, even if they say they know what they're doing, it's always concerning if they're not asking a lot of questions. Okay. So I think sometimes just that enthusiasm and the willingness to learn and that passion for the job.
As we look around this table, does anybody here feel like we know everything?
Yeah.
Even myself. I mean, I think, you know, it doesn't matter how long we've been in the industry. Zach with 3 months, myself with 30 years. I think we all learn a lot. And it's extremely important to remember that, you know, take the opportunity to learn from every, you know, situation that you go through, every person that you encounter, and go to these conferences. I mean, I'm not just saying that because we, you know, we're very much involved in the ASC, you know, the ASCA organization, the ASC Association. We really need to make sure that we continue getting education, that we meet people that can help us with this.
And I would say, by the nature of our company and the way everyone is educated in more than one thing, and now no one's necessarily the sole expert in one thing, has helped me to become much more comfortable in the industry, learning from multiple different people in multiple different ways, I think has accelerated me, I would say, in my training.
Yeah. And again, and to be said, also within an ASC environment, you're going to learn from a lot. If you're a new nurse manager, you should be spending time with not just the nurses in your organization, but get to know the administrator, get to know, you know, the people in the back. Certainly spend some time with the doctors, get to know the you know, each of the, you might not be involved in the operating room, for example, if you're in the PACU, but you really do need to know what's going on back there. You know, take some time visiting with the observing a couple procedures. If you're an operating room nurse, you know, step out, spend some time with the patient after they've recovered.
Yeah, well, there's so many facets of it, I think. I mean, I jokingly said yes. It's been a challenge for me because there's just so many different areas to look at. There's the clinical, and then there's the quality improvement and more of the administration types of things. And I think anybody, as a nurse manager going into something, it would be the same kind of thing, like Jenna said, when you're from the hospital, you've got your area, not that it's not a difficult job, but when you're responsible for the overseeing of an organization, it is a lot. You need some support.
Right. So, I mean, there is this perception, I think, among nurses that work in the hospital, that, oh, you know, I'm getting older, you know, maybe I'll go work in an ambulatory surgery center because it won't be that intensive. So, Jenna, as somebody that came from the hospital, what do you think of that observation?
Well, I think the other thing I know with a lot of our centers is that a lot of people are cross-training, so that nurses are PACU, OR, every area nurse, especially in our smaller centers, that, you know, especially when you only have 3 or 4 nurses at any given time, everyone needs to know everything.
Right.
So that probably is not necessarily going to be...
I mean, it's challenging in a different way, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
but it's not...
Stresses and difficulties in both places.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not like you're going and it's some slow pace.
Right, and I don't mean to minimize the hard work that they have in a hospital.
Yeah.
My point being is that if you're expecting your work to be less, that's not the case at all. And as you mentioned, the lack of backup in an ASA. And I don't mean that we're not running safely. It's just that you don't get to specialize when you're in an ambulatory surgery center, as you said.
So let's shift back to life safety again. Alex, what are some of the issues that we've been confronting recently in life safety?
Yeah, so one of the biggest ones, and actually sometimes one of the most costly, is the separation of the electrical branches. That's making sure that you have at least one panel for life safety, the critical branch, and then the equipment branch.
So up until recently, centers could be grandfathered.
Absolutely.
On this, if they were built before 2003. So what happened?
ASJ's just stopped allowing that.
Right.
Is what happened. And NFPA 99 became a code. It's no longer a standard.
Correct.
So it now mandates that all centers abide by these type 1
requirements. If you're doing general anesthesia.
Exactly.
So this has actually shut down some centers in New York City and is causing some considerable problems for those that can't meet those requirements or don't even have a generator for that matter.
Centers that have UPS systems, you know, are really running into issues where they've been running off of either a waiver or being grandfathered in. So that's no longer acceptable. UPSs aren't acceptable in many circumstances. For instance, when you have general anesthesia, you know, some pain centers can get away with UPS systems, but some AHJs are not allowing those either. So it really depends on your state. I know New York State has been a little bit more strict than others.
Right. But it is a CMS regulation and part of NFPA 99.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Where it's really how people are enforcing it. And being able to have a backup battery system is really one of the exceptions in NFPA 101, where, you know, there's certain requirements to meeting that.
So just like the nurses and just like other people, you have all kinds of initials or abbreviations. So I thought we'd probably better describe what AHJ stands for.
Yeah, AHJ is the authority having jurisdiction.
Correct. So in any given state, well, in any given circumstance, you're going to have an agency that has jurisdiction over that particular issue.
Right, because that could be the accrediting organization or the state enforcing it.
Right.
Really depends.
So other challenges that you have right now.
Yeah, other challenges, you know, we always have the firewall penetration issue. That is a very, very simple one to fix, a very difficult one to constantly maintain, we find. You know, IT will just come into the center, run some wire, and all of a sudden you have a penetration in your firewall. So checking every month or quarterly, however your center feels necessary, to make sure that those firewall barriers are maintained.
Got to watch out for those IT people.
Yeah, I shouldn't blame the IT people, but my father's an IT person, so sometimes I like to pick on them a little more.
Pretty much you have to follow them around whenever you're in the building.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and of course, that's one of the easiest things to fix. So and you made a point yesterday, or a couple days ago, when we were on a survey together, about how a surveyor, well, just mentioned what happens when a surveyor finds one penetration.
Oh, yeah. As soon as you find a penetration as a surveyor, you stop looking. So fixing those easy penetrations, for instance, in the walkway, as soon as they're walking up to the front desk, if there's a penetration there,
they're not even going to get into the ceiling.
right. They're not going to get above the ceiling. It saves them a lot of time.
Right.
They'll be really happy with you, but it won't leave them with a really good impression of your center. So,
well, and you can find yourself fixing only that problem and then realizing that when they come back and check somewhere else that you still have other penetrations.
Exactly. In the most common place is above the ceiling that you find them, where you don't see it every day. So sometimes you have to take out that ladder, which you need to have in your center. You need to have a ladder for the surveyors.
And a surveyor has no obligation to look for every single penetration. So as soon as they see one penetration that's not been sealed, they'll say, okay, that's all I need to see. Then they'll leave it up to you to figure out where all the penetrations are. And they'll look in a different location the next time they come back.
Absolutely. And that can lead into resurveys. I've seen that before, too. Not being able to tell the surveyors which product you use to seal it if you do have that resurvey. And then also not being able to show them that you have fixed them all. If they do find one on the visit, you have a bigger issue there.
Right.
Another issue that has come up quite a bit, and we've gotten a solid answer on this, is wood in the medical gas room. Those medical gas room doors have to be metal. And a lot of contractors like to put wood on the walls for mounting the gas manifolds. And that shouldn't be there. Not every surveyor is going to find that.
But it is a requirement.
It is a requirement.
And we verify that all the way up the ladder.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. At least Triple HC. Right. Triple HC will enforce that. So even if that wood is fireproof, that won't always get you away with it. It's really a code interpretation, unfortunately, but we do have a clear response here. Also, sticking with the medical gas room, signage is a constant issue. And I know this is a problem for a lot of centers because the rules, frankly, keep changing. But there are three signs that you need if you've got oxygen and other gases. There's one sign that's general, one sign for oxygen, and then one sign for any gas that is not oxygen. And then battery-operated lights are another common issue, making sure that all your exit pathways are covered by some sort of battery-operated lighting, whether that's built into your lights that are already there. The easiest way to tell that is with the little red button that you can do your 30-second test.
Let's talk about that 30-second test for a second, because, Sue, you actually have to... to get up on the ladders, or no? I guess you have this little thing. Yeah, she has this little tool that reaches up. It's like a
retractable or extendable.
Like those old antennas in our cars that would go up, and she's able to reach quite high. So, but you were surprised because one of the centers that you were doing that for, like quite a number of units were out, right? Or a couple of units were out.
Yeah, two or three of them, and a couple of them just were very faint when they came on, and another one just buzzed and nothing came on, but. They just replace the battery.
Right. Make sure you hold that button for 30 seconds. Make sure you really get a good test. And, and of course, once a year for 90 minutes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is somewhat of a fire safety issue, somewhat of a health issue is no smoking signage. We should be adding vaping and e-cigarettes to those signs now.
And your policies.
And in the policies, too. Yeah, those...
Yeah,
sometimes get away from us. So.
It's becoming a standard now that vaping and smoking is not allowable in the centers. Yeah, as well as immediately outside of them.
So those are a lot of the issues that we're seeing right now in life safety.
So I did want to thank all of our guests this time. Judy D'Ambrosio, Director of Clinical Service for AHS. Thank you for your insight on credentialing and education. Alex Bornan, Director of Operations and our resident life safety expert. For observations on life safety and everything in general. Jenna Alvarez, Senior Nurse Consultant, who heads up our, I don't know if you'd like to admit that, but you head up our new clients and onboarding process with the organization. Our newest employee, Zachary Caloritis, who is still learning every aspect of our operation, and very soon we'll be having him more often on the podcast, too, talking about all of the wonderful things that that he's learned here. So thank you for all for the great input. And we're going to be doing another podcast from our annual retreat coming up in June. So look forward to having all of you together again and putting a microphone in front of you and making you talk again. So thank you very much.
John, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies is really growing fast. We've been adding employees steadily over the past 12 months. Can you tell the listeners what's been happening?
So clearly, this podcast has been very popular, thanks, of course, to you and me, because of our wonderful work here, and our infectious, I don't know if I should be using infectious personalities in a podcast here about infection control and various items, but definitely we're enjoying doing this, and certainly the word is getting out about the great things that we're doing at AHS. So recently, we added infection prevention consulting to our services and mentoring of infection control preventionists in the organizations, and that's being headed up by Lori Rodericks, who is our newly certified CAIP individual. So she has the Certified Ambulatory Infection Preventionist certification now, and she's always been doing infection control for us, but now she's got this new title. So she can do ongoing infection control consulting, particularly if you don't have a qualified IC person on staff. She can help you in following up on infection control issues. She can do mentoring of infection control staff. And she can do infection control and sterile processing competencies. And we've also enhanced our life safety services by adding Jim Masters to our staff. He is a life safety surveyor, and so he joins Alex Borneman, who is our director of operations, to be able to do various life safety surveys and consulting on life safety issues, as well as probably the most important thing is follow up on life safety citations. That's a very difficult area for many organizations to be able to deal with. You know, what happens when you get a life safety citation? How do you deal with that? So we now have that ability. And of course, our unique retainer-based regulatory services, where we help keep you on top of all the ASC regulatory requirements and always make sure that you are survey ready.
So let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry.
So every episode, we inform you of upcoming events. And if you'd like to have your event included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
And we also want to remind you that the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is available to support your ASC association. John is available to speak, and the podcast can record a podcast from your meeting.
Right. And we're going to be doing that in California, New Jersey, New York. Yep. And we'll see if any other states are interested.
And registration is open for ASCA's 2019 National Advocacy Day. That'll be September 24th in Washington, D.C.
ASCA 2019 is coming up and will be at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center in Nashville, Tennessee, May 15th through May 18th, 2019. We will be there in force with Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies as well as the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. And I think I have three sessions there that I'll be talking during.
And the New Jersey State Association's 9th Annual ASC Conference is May 28th and 29th at the Hilton East Brunswick, Three Tower Center Boulevard, East Brunswick, New Jersey. And John will be the keynote speaker. And we will also be recording from there. For more information,
contact them at the New Jersey website at www.njaasc.org. The New York State Association of Ambulatory Surgery Center Spring Conference is June 5th through 6th in Saratoga Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.nysaasc.org. And lots of good content. I actually am the part of the program committee that puts together the program. So, and the ASC Podcast with John Gailey will be there.
Good. The Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology Incorporated, or APIC, is having their 46th annual conference on June 12th through 14th, 2019 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
The Tennessee ASC Association membership meeting is June 19th, 2019 at the AmSurg headquarters, Nashville, Tennessee.
The Gulf States ASC Conference is June 19th through the 21st, 2019 at the Ritz-Carlton, New Orleans.
The Arizona Ambulatory Surgery Association annual conference is June 27th and 28th, 2019 in Scottsdale, Arizona.
And the California Ambulatory Surgery Association's annual conference is September 4th through 6th, 2019 in Monterey Bay, California. For more information, please visit www.casurgery.org. And we will be there, right?
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. I think we're going to tack a little vacation on after that. Well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again in 2 weeks, and please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, All Rights Reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.